dismiss all anxiety from your mind and enter into the Call Me Catholic Show with your host, Peggy Normandin.
Whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is gracious, if there is any excellence and if there is anything worthy of praise, we're going to try to get to it in the next hour. I am Peggy Normandin, and you've arrived at the Call Me Catholic Show, where we celebrate, explore, and affirm our Catholic identity so we can wake up and say to the world each and every morning, oh yeah, you can call me Catholic. I am joined here in the studio by my indispensable engineer, Jimmy G. What's up, Jimmy?
I like being called indispensable. That makes me feel so good.
I think it sounds like a song, The Indispensable.
It boosts my self-esteem.
Well, no, you deserve more than that. You boost my self-esteem. We're coming to you from the Tower of Hope on the beautiful Christ Cathedral campus in Garden Grove through the airwaves of Immaculate Heart Radio. And hey, if you'd like to drop us a line on the Call Me Catholic Show, you can send us an email at peggy@callmecatholic.com. We'd love to hear from you. So we got another great show lined up for you today, but that should come as no surprise. We're all about the good shows, right, Jimmy G?
You better believe it.
Yeah, only the best for our listeners. So Mark Joseph, a very respected, very interesting film producer, author, music producer. In fact, this guy scored the original rock music score for the Passion of the Christ movie. How cool is that? It'll be fun to talk to him. He'll be coming up in our Muse in Review segment. He's got a fabulous movie out right now, Little Boy, that we'll discuss, but he likes to talk about faith and culture, so we're going to have an interesting conversation. But first, in our Did You See This segment, where we pull a news story or a current event and discuss it with our Catholic sensibility, we are going to talk about the Sacred Stones, the story of the Sacred Stones. Now, that kind of sounds like a Lord of the Rings trilogy movie, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's not fantasy, it's not fiction. It's a real-life story with lots of intrigue and lots of drama and lots of good Catholic history. So our story begins in Ovila, Spain, in the year 1200, when the King of Spain commissioned the construction of a beautiful, magnificent Gothic monastery for a fairly new Catholic religious order, the Cistercians, a monastic order of monks who had been around for about 100 years at that point. So this Cistercian monastery was magnificent, and it just thrived with its Cistercian inhabitants through the Middle Ages up until about the early 1800s, when the Spanish government reverted to a secular leadership and a lot of the religious orders were kind of run out of town. And these beautiful monasteries were in some cases turned over into private residences, in some cases abandoned. But there stood this beautiful Cistercian monastery no longer being used for its original purpose. So now fast forward to 1930. When William Randolph Hearst, the very wealthy newspaper tycoon, was on the hunt for European antiquities. You may recall, if any of you have ever traveled to Hearst Castle, Hearst had a passion, a voracious appetite for antiquities, and loved to incorporate elements of old castles and palaces into his homes. He collected medieval art and very, very old tapestries. He just couldn't get enough of them. So in 1930, one of Hearst's scouts, who was scouring Europe for antiquities, came upon the fairly well-preserved ruins of the Cistercian monastery in Ovila, Spain. And he encouraged Hearst to purchase as many of these magnificent limestone bricks and carvings and arches and portals from the old abbey as he possibly could. So for $50,000, Hearst purchased from the Spanish government what amounted to 11 shiploads of stones from the abandoned Cistercian Abbey in Ovila, Spain. And he brought them to San Francisco, where he wanted to use them to build an extravagant new summer estate up in Northern California. But at that time, like many Americans in the early 1930s, Hearst experienced a slight reversal in fortune, and it caused him to rethink the project. So he took all these stones, 11 shiploads of these holy stones, and he put them into storage for a couple of years.
Wow.
But that was expensive too. You know, imagine storing that vast number of stones. So he decided to unload them, and he gave them for a small price to the city of San Francisco, in particular the Golden Gate Museum Art Conservancy. And he suggested that they use it to build kind of a model monastery for the public to enjoy there in Golden Gate Park. So he left these crates in the possession of the Golden Gate Conservancy, where these crates for many years stood because the city kept trying to raise funds and they just couldn't do it. And then along came World War II. That interrupted their plans. So 11 shiploads of precious building materials got scattered about the Golden Gate Park and were exposed to major fires, to public theft, to abuse from the elements, and just general neglect. Until one day in the 1950s, a monk from the new Clairvaux Monastery in Vina, California, which happens to be a Cistercian monastery just outside of Chico, was walking through the Golden Gate Park and discovered this treasure trove of stones and its relevance to his Cistercian order, and thus began the process of reclaiming these massive and dramatically beautiful stones and returning them to their original purpose as home to the Cistercian order of monks. Now, I said that many of the stones were scattered throughout the park, but in fact, they determined that one complete building Hearst acquired in the ruins was the chapter house for the monks, which is usually the most important room in a monastery, and that the majority of these stones still lay crated up. And with some expert help, a lot of expert help, I would say, a plan was drafted to rebuild the chapter house on the site of the new Clairvaux Cistercian Monastery in Vina, California. And this morning, we have the privilege of speaking with the abbot of the new Clairvaux Cistercian Monastery in Vina, Abbot Paul Mark Schwann. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to the Call Me Catholic show.
You're welcome, Peggy. It's a great honor to be with you on your show and to speak with you.
Well, I'm looking forward for you to fill in some of the very colorful details about the evolution of this project. First of all, why don't you give us a little background on the new Clairvaux Monastery before this historic event started happening on your site?
We were founded in 1955. We were a foundation of our mother house of the Abbey of Gethsemane in Trappist, Kentucky. And we are part of that Cistercian reform of the 17th and 18th century that's often called Trappist.
So how did this process start, and how long has it been going on, the rebuilding of the chapter house on your site?
Actually, it was in 1992 when my predecessor as abbot here of the monastery, Father Thomas Davis, actually sat down with officials there in the city of San Francisco in Golden Gate Park and presented the case. And at that time, the city did award the stones to the monastery. And then the stones arrived in 19 truckloads in 1994. So he had 11 shipments by ship, and we had 19 truckloads of stone.
Wow.
And then the work began to each stone had to be measured. It had to be determined its ability to hold weight, because a lot of them were damaged, as you stated. And then all that was put into a computer, because all the numbering system was either missing or had been lost.
Sure.
But it was the new computer programs that had just been, developed, that allowed us to put each stone into the computer, its dimension, and this computer program put everything together.
Wow, so the computer kind of figured out for you what piece fit with what piece?
Exactly. It was just incredible, because without that, it would have taken many more years and much more money.
Well, that was very providential that technology came along that solved your problem.
It did. It had just been developed, so a nice blessing from God to make that possible.
Father, I had the pleasure of visiting that site because when our youngest son went to Chico State and he brought us over there, he said he'd gone to a retreat there. And he said, and there's an interesting story about this building that they're putting up. And it is absolutely, now I was there a couple of years ago, but the bricks, it is stunning. It is hard for me to actually describe how awesome and how majestic the arches are and the color, the striations of the brick and the limestone. It is so beautiful. And I think it's almost completed now, isn't it, the chapter house?
All the medieval stonework has been completed. We completed that 2 years ago in 2013. But if you recall with your visit then, you might remember that it sits in an empty concrete and steel shell. Of course, obviously, when we rebuild today, we have to meet earthquake code.
Right.
Every visitor that comes through, I just love when I'm on occasion, I'm over there, and guests come. And
the jaws drop.
They just drop, because especially people who have never been to Europe, have seen this architecture.
But the real beauty of it is so stunning, but also the relevance of it to your order, that you have this building 800 years old. That was originally designed for this, some of the earliest Cistercian monks in Spain. And now here you are perpetuating that legacy with the actual building. I just think that story is so moving and so really providential, how that all came to pass.
It really is. It still sends chills up my spine every time I think of it, that these stones also were awarded back to us.
As they should be.
As they should have been. And here we have it. And we were able to, you know, at least get to this point. We've still got a little ways to go. But to get it all back together in the city of San Francisco with all its resources and capacities, you would think, wasn't able to do that. So
I know. Is that amazing?
It's a great accomplishment.
Must have taken...
And it's clearly a work of God, as we see it.
Well, and it is now the oldest building in California. Is that correct?
It is, and it's one of the oldest buildings in all of the Americas.
Yeah. Well, we're not that old. Yeah, we're not that old. So this is ancient. Well, thank you, Abbot Schwan, for giving us some great insight into the journey of the sacred stones from Avila, Spain, to the new Clairvaux Monastery in Vina, California, where the original chapter house has been resurrected. Now, if our listeners would like to learn more about this remarkable Catholic story and perhaps contribute to its future, you can go to sacredstones.org. Is that the best place for them to go, Father?
I believe that site is still up. It would probably be a little better at this time because we're putting up a new website that go right directly to New Clairvaux.
Okay, New Clairvaux. That's CLAIRVAUX.org. NewClairvaux.org. And learn a little bit more about this incredibly fascinating story. And open up your pocketbooks so they can continue the project and continue the good work of their monastery. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your being with us, Abbot.
You are welcome, Peg. It's been a real pleasure to be with you.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking with producer, author, and commentator Mark Joseph on the spiritual side of Hollywood. This is Peggy Normandin, and you're listening to the Call Me Catholic Show on Immaculate Heart Radio. Staying with us, I'm Peggy Normandin, and you are listening to the Call Me Catholic Show. One of our passions here at Call Me Catholic is what we might call the state of the arts. In our weekly Muse and Review segment, we try to search for some depth, some relevance, some moral enrichment through the art, film, music, literature, TV, media world. We'll go wherever we can find it. And this morning, we have a kindred spirit with us on the show, Mark Joseph. Mark Joseph is an author, but he's also a film and music producer. He worked on The Chronicles of Narnia, Holes, and Because of Winn-Dixie, and that's only a couple of them, and I mention them because they're some of my favorites. He also produced the rock soundtrack for The Passion of the Christ, which is really cool. He's a well-spoken critic and promoter of good things for the soul to see and listen to. He's behind one of my very favorite new movies, Little Boy, which opened in theaters on April 24th. So, Mark Joseph, welcome to the Call Me Catholic Show.
Great to be with you. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it's great. Hey, now listen, you got to be frank with me here. When people call themselves a producer, I'm never really sure what that means. So I know what an actor is. I know what a screenwriter is, what a director is. But what involvement does a producer have in getting a project from, you know, the script onto the bigger little screen?
Well, that is a great question. A lot of people don't understand that, so you're not alone.
Thank you.
I always think of a producer as, in my case, sort of like a general contractor on a house.
Okay.
You might have, or an architect, you might have the vision for the house and what you want it to be, but you don't know how to lay tile or lay bricks or, you know, do a lot of the things, and you hire people who really have those areas of expertise.
Specializations.
Yeah. And so even within the name producer, there can be very different roles. So there's a producer. Sometimes an executive producer is the person who sometimes brings the resources to a film. A line producer is the person on the set who is barking orders and keeping people in line.
I don't like
that. That's right. There are different roles. But generally for myself, I tend to be, as a producer on my films, the guy who kind of comes up with the story or has the idea and then brings a great team of writers and directors, and then we all execute it together.
Excellent, excellent. Well, is this always been your passion? Is this always the field you've been drawn to?
You know, I spent about 10 years after college working in TV. I was a TV host. I was a TV producer. I did a lot of radio, and there was a music producer. I can't say I had planned to be a film producer, but I worked for a company called Walden Media on their record division side.
Okay.
And one day my boss came to me, the president of the company, and said, "We're closing down the record side. Why don't you come to our film division?"
Oh.
And so I wish I could say that I'd planned this out when I was 5 years old, but that's not the case, and God has a sense of humor.
Well, and you just followed the path that was kind of laid out for you. Now, Mark, you have a very strong theme of faith and spirituality in your projects, and you have some strong opinions about how we can use those themes really well in film and media. That's not always the case in Hollywood. I mean, we don't find that kind of a profile very often. Now, what formed your conscience about these views? Have you grown into them, or did you have this watershed moment when you recognized the need for more depth and morality in modern art?
Well, you know, I've always been an observer and consumer of media since I was a young child. I read voraciously, and, you know, I just noticed that I grew up in a very, very secular time in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
When I felt like film and record and other producers, they tried very hard, and they still to this day, they try very hard to keep religion out of stories. And I've always found that very odd. I'll give you one example I've written about before, the Johnny Cash movie Walk the Line.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who knows anything about Johnny Cash knows that Johnny had a tremendous love for God and a difficult relationship with God.
Mm-hmm.
And I write in one piece that he loved four things. He loved June Carter Cash. He loved God, he loved music, and he loved drugs.
Drugs, yeah, that's the unfortunate love.
And look, life is a struggle, and he really struggled and battled drugs, but I think toward the end of his life, he had really overcome it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you watch the Johnny Cash movie, Walk the Line, I wrote again that the movie covers three of his four loves, drugs, June, and music. But if you watch that movie, you would have no idea of the passion he had for God that really animated him.
And what was anchoring him, too. I mean, what was kind of getting him, continuing to give him the strength? I mean, that's that kind of unspoken voice that, you know, or unspoken voice, just that pushing that keeps us going forward because we know there's a greater power.
That's right. And so what I argue for is let's tell stories honestly. Mm-hmm. And the honest story of Johnny Cash's life, this is the true story, by the way, in his autobiography, he tried to commit suicide in a cave in Tennessee.
Hmm.
And he went into this cave. It's a very hard cave to get out of once you go deep into it.
Oh.
And he went into this cave, and at some point he laid down hoping to just die, and he heard the voice of God tell him, "You are not in charge of the day of your death. I am, and it's not happening today."
Wow.
I mean, think about that for a second.
That would have been a great scene in a movie. I mean, my gosh. Yeah. So why are they scared? Why it only shows depth and a heightened, you know, sort of interest in more dimension than this kind of one-note thing we're getting.
Yeah, and so that's a prime example of really unnatural, awkward, frankly, storytelling that's not true. It's actually a lie not include such an important moment that developed his character and who he was. And so it's not that the director and writers are bad people. They just can't even comprehend that experience.
Well,
if you can't comprehend it, you can't tell the story.
You can't, you doubt your ability to tell it authentically. You know, another example of that, I think, is the Unbroken movie, because Louis Zamperini you can't read that book without saying, wow, his faith was the final, I mean, that was the permeating theme there, and it certainly drew it all together in the end. And it was really just very distantly touched on.
Yeah, I would challenge your listeners to even go read reviews by secular mainstream critics. Even they review this film and say it was just a 2-hour torture fest with no redemption. And that's because the Angelina and the writers chose not to include the last 30 pages of the book about him, which is, as you know, he goes to a Billy Graham crusade. Mm-hmm. Has a conversion, and that changes his entire outlook. So I've experienced, you know, 47 years or less of just stories where people very intentionally try to keep religion out. And I'm not necessarily one who pushes faith-based movies, but I think if stories are told authentically, then there's no need to even call it faith-based. Really, what I'm arguing this for is let's keep faith-ignorant movies from being made. Then we'll all enjoy the movie.
Well, you know, and stories and fiction have always been the way people communicate with each other, important truths. And, you know, so I love a good story, too, but it has to be told honestly or it comes up empty for me.
Yeah, the other example that I would give you, and I'm writing about this right now, I should have a piece out in the next couple of weeks or so, but You know, I thought back to TV shows. Remember the show I Love Lucy?
Of course.
Lucille McGillicuddy was her maiden name. I think she's Irish. I think it's a good chance to say she's probably Irish Catholic.
Okay.
And then, of course, Ricky Ricardo is from Cuba. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm putting my money in the fact that they're both Catholics. Now, when did we ever see them go to Mass or talk to a priest in the entire run of that show?
Hmm.
So it takes a lot of effort to keep out Ricky and Lucy's faith, their Catholic faith, from that show. Why are we doing that? Why can't we tell stories honestly? Why didn't the Brady Bunch go to church? I'm pretty sure the Brady Bunch in real life would have gone to church if they were a normal family of six and they had those values.
They would have taken up a whole pew, too.
Yeah. How come they were never shown as part? You know, we see them having fun in the backyard, playing sports. How come we never saw the Brady Bunch go to a church service? That takes a lot of effort.
Well, this is your business. Why? I mean, it's a wholesome thing. People are drawn to that. People relate to it. I mean, half of America goes to church, I would say, at least. Another 25% would like to say they do. They just don't. So why are they eliminating that from our lifestyle dramas and in comedies?
Well, you know, I'm not a good person to defend when people do irrational things. I don't have an explanation other than I think part of it has to do with sort of the, look, part of it is the faith community's fault. The faith community did not train people to go to Hollywood to be screenwriters and storytellers. So you have a generation of storytelling that has been done by fairly secular people until more recently. So part of it I would put back on the church community saying to priests and pastors, why didn't you train people to be screenwriters and actors and producers and directors?
Mm-hmm.
We'll take that for the faith community. But on the other side, I think some people have a misguided notion that faith is divisive,
mm-hmm.
and, gee, we shouldn't show that Brady's going to church because then such group would be offended.
Yeah, somebody else might be offended by that. But nobody ever is.
Right.
Nobody ever is.
Right. But, again, let's go back to the story. And, again, look at the way that Brady's lived their lives. I'm putting my money on the fact that they were somewhat religious people.
Mm-hmm.
Let's let that authentic story be told. Mm-hmm. If they were regular church attenders, let's make going to church part of the comedy or part of the story for whatever.
Sure. I mean,
let's not. Why are we working overtime to pretend that we're such a secular people when we're actually the second most religious country on earth after Ireland?
I like your point. I mean, you really lay it out very, very vividly. So, Mark, you have six children, I understand. Is that right?
I do.
And what is the age span of those children?
They are 14 years old to 6 weeks old.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, well, congratulations. So you do have a coming-of-age child, and that is the point at which I really, as a parent, I felt myself at odds with Hollywood because I just thought, wow, what do I tell my kids to go see, and how do I keep them from going to see all this garbage? So do you think there is any place for kind of the vapid humor stuff like the Hangover series or anything that Will Ferrell is in?
I mean, sure, I think we all like to have fun, and, you know, I think of God as having an incredible sense of
right.
humor. I mean, first of all, he invented us, and, you know, a lot of humor to invent us the way he did and all the things he did for us. But you know, there's a great passage in the Old Testament when I think it's the prophet Elijah. He's having a kind of a face-off with the prophets of Baal, I think it is, and at one point, Elijah, you know, has God asks God to rain down fire on a sacrifice, and God does. And then the prophets of Baal try to do it, and it doesn't happen. And Elijah says, you know, gee, where is your God? Maybe he's on the toilet. I mean, the fact that a prophet of God is saying a joke like that, and that God puts it in the Bible,
yeah.
right?
There you go. It's those hidden punchlines we got to look for. Well, we're going to take a short break, but film producer and commentator Mark Joseph is going to stay with us. And when we come back, he'll talk about some of his upcoming projects, including a bioepic on President Ronald Reagan. Now I've got your attention, Orange County. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you're listening to the Call Me Catholic Show. We'll be right back.
May 18th through May 23rd is Wills and Trusts Week in the Diocese of Orange and is proudly sponsored by the Orange Catholic Foundation and the Catholic Cemeteries. Take advantage of one of the free sessions and learn how to protect those you love with a new or updated estate plan. Through proper planning, the legacy of love and care you leave for your family and friends can be encouraging and inspiring. If you have questions on how to begin or update your estate plan, please join us at one of the many sessions planned
and at convenient parish locations throughout our diocese during the week of May 18th. For a complete list of locations and schedule, visit our website, orangecatholicfoundation.org. That's orangecatholicfoundation.org. Or call 714-282-3021. That's 714-282-3021. Admission is free and reservations are not necessary but welcome. Details are available at orangecatholicfoundation.org. We look forward to seeing you soon.
Welcome back to the Call Me Catholic Show. I'm your host, Peggy Normandin, resuming our fascinating conversation with film and music producer Mark Joseph, who is also an author, a commentator, and a father of six. He's kind of a Renaissance guy. Hey, Mark, let's talk about Little Boy. I loved Little Boy, which is a movie that just opened in the theaters on April 24th. I happened to attend a screening of it with my husband and my 23-year-old son, and we all came away saying, what a great movie, and we all enjoyed it. We all probably took away something different, but it spanned generation and gender right there. It's a great movie. How's it doing in the box office?
It opened at number 13 last weekend, and it did about just under $3 million in business, but I wish I could say I was a producer on this one, but I was just helping my friends Eduardo and Alejandro, who you may know, getting the word out about it.
We love Alejandro.
But yeah, it's a fascinating story because the critical and average responses have been so radically different. Sometimes I think people are watching a different movie. If you go to RottenTomatoes.com, this is where they aggregate all the scores of critics. And the score from critics is 13% out of 100, which means they really hate the movie. The score from the fans there is 87% out of 100.
Wow, huge discrepancy.
So, yeah, literally, I'm wondering if they're watching the same film. And, you know, the discrepancy is not so much, I find, necessarily sort of ideological or philosophical or religious. It's more about professional film critics versus the average person.
Yeah.
And there's really a gap there. And one thing I know about Americans is Americans don't like to be told what to like.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, sometimes if we're told to like something, we'll do the opposite.
Yeah, we're like petulant teenagers.
That's right. We are a collection of all the rabble-rousers from around the world gathered in America.
And darn proud of it.
That's right. And so it is fascinating to me. I found the film personally, you know, well-made, of twists and turns of a story that just isn't yet figured
lots
out.
Lots of surprises.
And it raises difficult issues like racism, and yet I didn't feel attacked as an American. I felt affirmed that we're capable of overcoming racism, you know, if we keep our wits about ourselves. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but the 73-point gap between fans and critics is the second largest in the history of cinema on 1,000 screens or more.
Wow. Well, and it's not even on that many screens right now, is it? I mean, it's going to grow. I think there's going to be a groundswell of exposure when people are going to demand it.
It opened on 1,000 screens, and the previous record holder, I believe, was a 76-point gap. I don't recall the name of the film, but so, you know, you can make cinema history this week by liking a movie you're told not to like.
Well, I've told everybody I can find, every pulse I can find, go see this movie, because I really like movies that are wholesome but deep, too. They're not shallow, and you don't feel like you're getting fed an agenda. I even thought it had kind of this Wes Anderson sort of stylized look to it that was very cool. So good luck with that, and America, go out and see Little Boy. You will not be disappointed. So now let's talk a little bit about your involvement with the Narnia series. So you were involved in the very first of the Narnia series, which was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. So was it Mark Joseph, the father of six children, or Mark Joseph, the faithful, that drew you to want to work on the C.S. Lewis classic series?
Well, one of the first things I realized going to work for Walden was that we were going to develop this Narnia movie. And it was very exciting. I got the second draft of the script, actually, and I still have a copy of it because nobody will believe me when I tell you that the second draft and the early draft just had horrendous things in there. I talk about this in my book.
What do you mean by horrendous?
Well, let me tell you. I talk about this in my book, which is called The Lion, the Professor, and the Movies, Narnia's Journey to the Big Screen. But the first draft actually had the children swearing at each other using the F word and other words that I can't repeat on a family
you're
show.
You're kidding. C.S. Lewis, close your ears in the grave.
Right. He's
in heaven.
Sitting in his grave right now.
Yeah.
He and Tolkien are spinning in their respective graves because they, Tolkien reviewed Narnia as well. But it was just a complete disconnect. And, you know, there were people involved, fortunately, myself and others, who brought up that this is crazy. We cannot have these nice British children from 1943 swearing at each other.
And they wouldn't have. I mean, that wasn't in the book. That wouldn't have been in context.
No, it doesn't make sense. It's not true. And they were generally just annoying, incorrigible children. And so I made a lot of notes early on. And all along the way, we had to kind of correct the train from going off the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And I would especially single out Doug Gresham, who was C.S. Lewis' stepson, Michael Flaherty at Walden, Rick Dempsey at Disney, and others. But, you know, when people aren't involved to understand the heart of the story, that can often happen. So, thankfully, we didn't go forward with that X-rated version or R-rated version. We got it correct.
Might have been
later.
A cult classic. But so if our readers want to hear some of this good behind-the-scene juicy stuff, they can get your book, The Lion. Let's see. It's called The Lion, The Professor, and the movies, right?
And the movies. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anywhere where fine books are sold. Well, let's talk about what you've got planned for the future. I understand that you have a bioepic in the works on President Ronald Reagan.
I do. Very exciting. We've got a great script. Howard Klausner, we talked earlier about, you know, how movies are produced, but the writer that I brought on board was a writer named Howard Klausner. He wrote the movie Space Cowboys, the mm-hmm. Clint Eastwood movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so I brought the story to Howard, and he did a terrific draft of the script. And so we've been in development and pre-production. We hope to be shooting this fall. If our financiers keep their word, we'll start shooting this fall and hope to have it out next year.
Well, but, so 2016
earlier,
then.
Yeah, we were talking earlier about, you know, letting faith play a natural role. And as I said, I don't like to make overbearing, you know, religious movies that bonk you over the head.
Mm-hmm.
But really, just let faith play the role that it played in that person's life and don't shy away from it. And in Reagan's case, his mother was a very, very devout Christian woman.
Hmm.
As many of us have had mm-hmm. Christian moms, we know what that's like.
Yeah,
when you know your mother is praying for you, it's hard to do a lot of bad things.
or admit
but,
to them.
That's right. But his mother played a really important role. And also, the pastor at his church where he grew up was a denomination called Disciples of Christ. And,
mm-hmm.
and also the pastor played an important role. And so that really forms the foundation of Reagan's life. And, you know, once you oftentimes faith is a driving factor in a person's life. And it explains certain things about that person later in life. So I'd say in Reagan's case, the fact that the faith of his mother, but also the fact that he was a lifeguard.
Oh, okay.
And, you know,
he looks like he would have been a lifeguard.
That's right. He does. And he saved 77 lives as a lifeguard.
Really?
And one of the things he talked about later was the thing about a lifeguard, he said, is that oftentimes he would save somebody who was drowning, and instead of thanking them, they would actually be angry at him and swear at him afterwards.
Wow.
And they would say, I wasn't drowning. Why did you save me? You were just trying to show off.
Oh. Wow. And, hubris and, right there, man.
Right.
And spades.
So Reagan kind of gets accustomed to thinking he needs to save people, even though they're not going to thank him later, mm-hmm. and they'll probably cuss him out.
And they don't know they need to be saved.
That's exactly right. The lifeguard has a purview of things that the person in the water doesn't.
That's interesting.
And that also forms his character and who he becomes as a politician later.
Well, do you spend equal amount of time on his childhood and his career in the movies and in politics, or do you give us just a little intro and then go right into his adulthood?
No, we do. What makes our movie unusual, there's a certain Hollywood formula of doing biopics, and you'll see it over and over again, and it's to pick a short period in somebody's life, like 3 days or a week or something,
mm-hmm.
and build a whole story around that. I just didn't want to do that with this one, and so we begin the film present day with two Russians, and one is a KGB agent who followed Reagan for 40 years.
Mm.
And the two of them, one becomes the storyteller, and we immediately go back to Ronald Reagan at 11 years old.
Uh-huh.
And we pick up from 11 onward until the end of his life.
Well, you know, as you're telling me this, what's interesting, Mark, is that I don't remember any movies being made about Ronald Reagan, and he's such an iconic figure in American history. Have there been many of these kinds of movies already done about him?
No, there's never been one in his entire life, and I'm so thankful that my friends in Hollywood have no clue how much this person is admired in America, because there was one attempt made about 12 years ago that became a TV miniseries.
Mm-hmm.
But thankfully, there have been lots of documentaries, but no narratives, and so we really have the road to ourselves, and we're looking forward to getting it out there.
Well, I'm excited about it. We're big Reagan fans, but he had so many good quotes. I remember one. You're speaking about him being a very much of a God-fearing man. There was some quote, very humorous quote, about the fact that he thought he wondered what the Ten Commandments would look like if Moses had to pass them through Congress. I remember something
right.
to that effect.
Right. You know, I would just encourage your listeners. We have a Facebook page. Reagan the movie, and if you go there
okay.
every day, We put up a different quote from Reagan.
Oh,
actually,
great.
One of those is in one of the memes up there. But
it was such a perfect Reagan quote because it was witty, it was wise, and it was just, brevity is the soul of wit. It just went right to it. So, hey, do you have Reagan cast yet?
We have signed some of the talent. We've signed about 3 actors. We have several more that we're in conversations with. I would love to come on your show and tell you when we announce them, but we have not announced publicly yet.
Okay, well, I respect that. You're in the business. We're going to respect that. Well, that sounds really fun and interesting, and I know that's going to get a great reception, so we'll follow it on Facebook, and we will look forward to hearing more from Mark Joseph. You're just a really great interview, Mark, and we thank you for spending some quality time with us on the Call Me Catholic show, and we'll look forward to the release of your Reagan movie next year, and if you want to know more about the Narnia films, you can find Mark's book, The Lion, The Professor, and the Movies, wherever fine books are sold. So I hope you'll come back on and join us again, Mark.
Thanks for having me. Great to be with you guys.
Okay, thanks, Mark. And you can send me an email with your comments, suggestions, or questions at peggy@callmecatholic.com. We're going to take a quick station break, and when we come back, we'll bring you another chapter in our My Sainted Mother series, Stories from a Catholic Life. So stay right where you are. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you're listening to the Call Me Catholic show on Immaculate Heart Radio. Everybody, this is the Call Me Catholic show. I'm your host, Peggy Normandin. We've had a couple of great guests on the show this morning, and I want to remind our listeners how to stay in touch with their stories. So first of all, I want to thank Abbot Paul Mark Schwan from the New Clairvaux Monastery in Vina, California, for sharing his remarkable stories of their sacred stones. If you'd like to know more about the New Clairvaux Cistercian Monastery in Vina, California, where they are bringing back to life the sacred stones from a 13th century Cistercian monastery in Ovila, Spain, to their original purpose as the chapter house for this religious order, you can read more about it at newclairvaux.org. That's newclairvaux.org. And a big thanks to producer and film commentator Mark Joseph for sharing his insight on faith and culture in Hollywood. Remember to catch his latest movie, Little Boy. You're going to love it. And check out his book, The Lion, The Professor, and the Movies, about making the Narnia movies. And of course, stay up to date on what's going on with his Reagan biopic by going to his Facebook page. That's right. He wanted us to go to the Reagan movie Facebook page. So definitely go and stay in touch with that, because it sounds like it's changing every day and it's got a lot of entertaining material on there. And if you want to stay in touch with me, you can send me an email with your comments or suggestions to peggy@callmecatholic.com. So now we're going to bring you another chapter in our My Sainted Mother series, Stories from a Catholic Life. These are recorded conversations with people recalling a moment, a memory, just a little excerpt from their journey. You know, I've always loved hearing people's stories. I love hearing people talk about experiences or observations that have shaped and sharpened their relationship with the faith that we all love. Now, today's story comes from Marie, who tells us about her mother's faithful devotion to Our Lady of Perpetual Help, and how her mother's prayers to Our Lady never failed to deliver the graces they needed to survive some pretty dark days during the Depression.
I grew up with a story that my mother told me many times as I was growing up. It certainly did impress me about the power of prayer, the great, great, wonderful, helpful power of prayer. It was in the early 20s.
Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
We were very poor. There was a depression on. Everybody was poor. My dad worked at different jobs and made very little income. Mother never knew how much she was going to be able to have. She stayed at home, took care of us all, and managed with whatever he brought in. As we were growing up, so there was my sister, my brother, and myself, my mom and dad. We had a devotion. We would all kneel down in my mother and dad's bed and say the rosary.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with you. Blessed are you among women, blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners.
And it was always a privilege to be the one that led the rosary, and kind of a little bit of sibling rivalry there. At the end of the rosary, my mother would have all the saints that she knew and was familiar with, but Our Lady of Perpetual Help, I definitely remember, was the first one she would always say, Our Lady of Perpetual Help, pray for us.
Our Lady of Perpetual Help is a title given to the Blessed Virgin Mary, associated with the Byzantine icon of the same name, said to be from the late 15th century. The icon depicts the Blessed Virgin Mary wearing a dress of dark red with blue mantle and veil. The Christ child is portrayed clinging to his mother with a dangling sandal. Mary holds him in her arms reassuringly, lovingly. Christ's little hands are pressed into Mary's as a reminder to us that, just as on earth, he placed himself entirely in her hands for protection, so now in heaven, he has given into her hands all graces to distribute to those who ask her. This is at the heart of the devotion to Our Lady of Perpetual Help.
And my mother was keeping house in the part of Los Angeles where we lived, and there was a knock on the door. She went to the door, and it was two Little Sisters of the Poor. The Little Sisters of the Poor are an order, they're still active today. They wore regular long black habits and the veils, and they went door to door, always walking in twos, begging for help for the poor people. The elderly poor people would mostly.
Alms for the poor, ma'am. Please, ma'am.
She went to the door, and it was two Little Sisters of the Poor. Oh, she said, come on in. I'm sure that she invited them in, as she always did. They sat at a little table and had a glass of milk and a few graham crackers, I guess. And then her heart started pounding because she realized that they wanted a donation for their poorhouse. And the only money she had was $1, which had to last for about a week and feed her little family that length of time. So she kind of wrestled with it, but it was time for the nuns to go. And she told me that her pride overtook her. And she went and got the $1 bill and came and put it in their hand and wished them well. They hadn't left very long when she realized, what have I done, she said to herself. Look what my pride made me do. I haven't got anything for dinner for three nights, probably, before I get any more money. And she just started to sob. It's my pride that made me do that. And she cried and cried and cried. And then she prayed and prayed and prayed to Our Lady of Perpetual Help. And she just asked her, please, to help her accept this, to help her not to be so prideful about things. After a while, she went on about her work with a sad, heavy heart. And there was a knock on the door, pounding and whooping, hollering of friends, like. She ran to the door, and there were her cousins from Whittier, which is quite a little ways from where we lived. And they were a family that had a ranch. They called it a ranch. It was actually a walnut grove. And they came trooping in. I think there were two or three of them, maybe four of them, hugging and kissing, where they were an Irish clan, you know. And boxes and boxes of stuff they brought in and filled her refrigerator. There was a chicken, 2 dozen eggs. There were oranges and there were walnuts. And they really filled the larder there. And then they had to go off. So off they went. And down on her knees went my mother, with thanks to Our Lady of Perpetual Help. I guess as I look back, I say that was my mother's role model there, because that is the way she then went on. And she never, never closed the door on anyone who came and asked for anything. And this extended on into days that I very well remember, when the beggar knocked on the door and said, I'm hungry, I want something to eat.
I'm really hungry. It's hard out there, man. Appreciate it, man. It's so hard out there.
And my mother would say, sit down here. And she'd sit him down on the front porch and go in and fix him whatever it was. Peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Always milk. And she'd set him on the front porch. Then she'd come out and make sure his hands were clean with a washcloth and all, and then she'd hand him the plate of food. Always remembering in her heart those days when she needed food and Our Lady of Perpetual Help helped her. Mother's always answering the door and asking the sisters in for a little sustenance, a little rest, and always giving them money if she had it. It has always inspired me, and I think those dear sisters are still doing the same thing in their in a more modern way. And they have that wonderful home for the poor, the poor house, as they call it, in Wilmington. And it is a favorite charity of mine. That story brings a tear to my eye every time I think about it and every time I tell it. But to me, that's a story of true, wonderful faith.
The Little Sisters of the Poor are an international congregation of Roman Catholic women religious, founded in 1839 by St. Jean Jougan. Their mission is to offer the neediest elderly of every race and religion a home where they will be welcomed as Christ, cared for as family, and accompanied with dignity until God calls them to Himself. To learn more about the Little Sisters of the Poor, visit littlesistersofthepoor.org.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
That's a special story. Hey, thanks everybody for joining us today on the Call Me Catholic show. Don't forget to drop me a line at peggy@callmecatholic.com. Jimmy G and I are grateful for your input so we can keep on bringing you all the good news from our good faith. Right, Jimmy G?
Exactly. The folks have great stories they want us to share. Hey, share them.
Yeah. Comments, stories, good recipes. I'll take those too.
Exactly. Cookies.
Yeah. So until we meet again, I'm Peggy Normandin, but you can, you know, always call me Catholic.
I gotta have faith.